This week on Breezy Breakfast, we consider Bill 23, the More Homes Build Faster Act. We hear from rural planner David Douglas, Guelph's Green MPP Mike Schreiner, and Bill McPinn, broadcast journalist and teacher of government relations at Seneca College. Bill 23 has been presented as a bill to address housing shortfalls in Ontario. Experts in planning, housing, and municipal finance believe it is anything but affordable. Skepticism runs high about the likelihood of Bill 23 creating any truly affordable housing in Ontario. Listen to our experts as they address these issues and respond to concerns for our breakfast guests.
Good morning, everyone, on this cold Thursday, December 1st. Today's topic is Bill 23. As we gather, we are reminded that Guelph is situated on treaty land that is steeped in rich Indigenous history and home to many First Nations, Inuit, and Métis people today. As a city, we have a responsibility for the stewardship of the land on which we live and work. Today, we acknowledge the Mississaugas of the Credit First Nation of the Anishinaabeg peoples on whose traditional territory we are meeting. We are in the midst of the autumn of our discontent. Between the invocation and subsequent rescinding of the notwithstanding clause to keep students in class, the November 4th announcement regarding the opening of the Greenbelt, and the timing of the introduction of Bill 23, which was the day after Ontario municipal elections, it's a wonder that Ontarians have had the wherewithal to push back at the provincial government's machinations and perturbations. Bill 23 was passed on November 28th of this year. While this particular battle has been lost, don't despair, for the regulations for Bill 23 are still being developed. And due to public pushback, some changes were made to the bill prior to its passage. For example, third parties, residents, or environmental groups may make appeals to the Ontario Land Tribunal. Municipalities do have jurisdiction to enforce green building standards on developers, and development fee discounts are to be granted to certain development projects, and in particular, those regarding building of rental housing. These discounts will be effective retroactively as of January 2022. Now, the first two amendments sound pretty good, but I'd say the jury is out on the third one. Now, today, our focus is on Bill 23, but please remember that the Ford government intends to pass more legislation faster. The opening of the Greenbelt, Bill 39, which is the Better Municipal Government Act, and a review of A Place to Grow and the provincial policy statements are coming soon to a rally near you. Under the guise of building more and ostensibly affordable housing, Bill 23 will actually result in building monster homes in the Greenbelt, on wetlands, and on protected green spaces, ignoring the advice of conservation authorities, making regional official plans useless, and finally, it will not provide more affordable housing. Today, our guests are David Douglas, a rural planner and professor emeritus with the University of Guelph, Mike Schreiner, Guelph's Green MPP, and Bill McBain, a former Queen's Park insider and current broadcast journalist. David, I'd like to ask you to start us off.
Okay, thank you very much, Tanya. Thank you to my fellow presenters and to our listeners for joining us on this. It's very hard to know where to start in this particular item. The tendency is, first of all, to scream or to ramble on or get even into something of a tirade with this pernicious piece of legislation. It's as bad a public policy that I have seen in over 50 years of experience and practice in community development, urban and regional planning, and related fields. So the question is, where does one start on this? Perhaps the better place to start is at the foundation. For the very foundations of our democratic values are at stake here. Like rats or termites, incrementally nibbling away at our foundations will topple the structure eventually. And whether it's through the inappropriate notwithstanding clause that this government invoked, the shutting off of workers' rights to negotiate, now, by the way, thrown out by the courts, the beggaring of nurses and educational workers, or as indicated, this latest, this Bill 23, ramming through the autocratic and anti-democratic so-called strong mayor's bill, this government is assuredly undermining the very foundations of democracy in Ontario. And that, as I've said in recent public column in the Guelph Mercury Tribune, it attacks the fundamental values of our community, the fundamental values that make Guelph, Guelph. Naming an omnibus bill that dismantles much of Ontario's hard-won and progressive urban and regional planning framework for our communities is at best cynical, if not downright destructive. And the great irony is, of course, is that a progressive conservative government of Bill Davis and others introduced much of the progressive legislation that our modern Ontario, on current Ontario, is built on. Naming this bill as a housing bill and implying affordable housing is even more cynical and cunning. It does extremely little for the provision of affordable housing and will likely exacerbate the problem itself. Keeping out a host of interested parties, such as the Association of Municipalities of Ontario, our principal organization for local government in this province, is a distasteful and anti-democratic act. It runs completely against the long tradition of intergovernmental cooperation and collaboration, which is a long Canadian tradition, and it breaches all sorts of trust and respect. They are disappointed, they're insulted, they're disgusted, and they're on record in saying this. They oppose this bill. Even more cynical and cunning, as you noted, was the timing of this initiative, slinking around the election season for municipalities throughout Ontario. Municipalities had a last-minute chance to formulate some response. This is hardly collegial input, and they were caught undergoing orientation after their election when this bill was slipped through in the dark. And yet, there is more on this matter of the sly cunning and timing of this very complex legislation. The legislation itself, as you know, is 71 pages in length. And as you may know, Guelph City Council had a special council meeting on this a week or so ago or less, and in its very first meeting, and it unanimously opposed the bill, as have many other municipalities. And then there is the evisceration of the community planning process itself that you alluded to. Where to start here? For development of 10 or fewer housing units, just as one example, it's essentially 3 years ago. Off you go and build. No site planning or urban design is required. You can forget that. Water management, don't really bother about that. Trees, forget it. You know, we don't have to deal with these things. Then the upper tier municipalities have really no say in their lower tiers plans. So the fundamental rationale of integrated planning, left hand knowing what right hand is doing, this is essentially abandoned. And then of course the minister can interfere at any time with Guelph's official plan and any amendments at will. All he or she has to say is that there is some provincial interest at stake here, and this is what you are going to do, exactly as they dictate in the so-called Strong Mayors Act. The public right to appeal the development process, this has largely been amputated. And yes, as indicated, there's been some backtracking on this following the protest and the surge of opposition to this. But the very fact that basic community rights of appeal and engagement were at stake has got to send a chill down our collective spines. And if you lose at the non-elected Ontario Land Tribune, well, guess what? Well, you pay the winner's costs. Sorry about that. So go mortgage the house, sell the children, close the farm, and pay more costs to the developers, who, by the way, will be getting, according to the AMO, $1 billion extra dollars a year following this transfer, a transfer from the private to the private pockets from the public realm. On the green belt, as indicated, where developer cronies have just been awarded 7,400 acres, essentially free, breaching the 2005 legislation, and indeed breaching the Premier's own public promise to stay away from this preserve. So you and your children and your grandchildren's foodlands and open space preserve is now at risk. Now we have the nefarious practice of incremental erosion of the Greenbelt, depending on the incumbent government's preferences. Even though the housing need projections are suspect, see the Canadian Environmental Laws Association's piece on this, Ontario has been actually building more than enough housing in the last 5 years. The actual data shows we are able to build plenty of houses to meet the need. And by the way, the need may well be exaggerated. And by the way, most of the required serviced land, available land, is already designated in the GTA to provide the needed housing. The need is not there. The plan to respond to the need is at best corny, if not cronyism. You mentioned conservation authorities. Well, these world-renowned, first on the watershed planning scene since the 1940s, these are essentially now muzzled and told to get out of the land use planning business. The bill now passed will just make more and more people cynical and suspicious of the very notion of government. They're crooks. They look after their own. They can be bought. They cannot see beyond the next election. And anyway, they just buy their way into the next election, don't they? Is this what we need when the world is fighting for the very concept of democracy in Ukraine, in Iran, and elsewhere? And here in these dangerous and fragile times for democracy, we debase it. We debase the very notion of democracy and essentially say it's up for the highest bidder. So dangerous times, dangerous legislation, legislation that has nothing to do with the provision of affordable housing, but essentially dismantles community development and the community process of self-reliance, self-determination, and locally based planning. It's bad news. Welcome to Trump North.
Thank you, David, for that great overview. I'd like to go to Phil because he'd like to talk about the loss of revenue that will accompany the decrease of development charges. Phil?
I think David has hit virtually every nail on the head. And while he talks about Trump North, I'm going to talk about Thatcher West. You're sitting in Thatcher West while I'm sitting in Thatcher Land. I'm extremely concerned about funding. We are looking at the potential of a minimum of 2, and I would say likely more percentage tax increases above what are currently projected because of losses of revenue. Further, there is no evidence at all, and in fact, there is evidence to the contrary, that the provincial government is literally washing their hands of this, and there is an expectation that if there are shortfalls in development funds, that the provincial government will expect municipalities to look to the federal government to assist municipalities on this. In essence, what they're doing is attempting to avoid any responsibility for the literally billions of dollars that are needed in order to house people into the future. If we consider right now that we are looking at approximately $300 per square foot construction cost in Guelph alone for the housing that we need at a very minimum, we would need somewhere between $100 million and $250 million to provide subsidized social cooperative and other form of housing. And as people have seen in the news lately, we don't even have a definition on what affordable housing is at this point. Yet we do know that young people between the ages of 18 and 25 right now are paying upwards of 60% of their earned income for housing and are falling approximately $1,000 a month short on their earnings. And this at a time when we are calling for a living wage, which is just above minimum wage, suggests to me that we have a significant financial shortfall that is going to be coming to the cities and to residents of those cities in the future.
Thank you, Phil. I just wanted to comment that I believe that Bill 23 defines affordable as being 80% of market costs, whereas the rest of the world would want to define affordable based on income. So with that,
Just a quick one on that one. I completely resent that definition. 80% of $3,000 is still a significant amount of money that no one can afford to pay if they are beginning their working lives between the ages of 18 and 25. That's an absolute nonsense statement on what affordability is.
It is an insult. So with that, I'd like to go to Mike Schreiner, our MPP. Mike?
Yeah, thanks, Tanya. And I appreciate you mentioning the definition of affordability. I was going to bring that up. David did an excellent summary of the bill. And given that it's an omnibus bill, it's pretty hard to do a quick summary in 10 minutes. And so I would only add a couple things to David's comments. Is one, it changes a lot of things around the Heritage Act. And so I know a lot of Guelph counselors, Leanne Karen in particular, Kathy Downer, Phil, others who have really fought for Heritage over the years. So I would add another wrecking ball to Heritage to David's long list. And I would just to comment on Phil's comments around development charges. What makes the changes to development charges so egregious is the change in definition of 80% of market. There is nothing affordable of 80% of market when you have market rates going completely out of control. And so to offer developers a waiving of development charges to build housing that's, quote, affordable, that really is not affordable, is especially egregious. I think there could be a case made, or there can be a case made, if you were going to waive development charges for deeply affordable nonprofit and co-op housing that was 30% of people's income, and have the province make municipalities whole by replacing that revenue. But the way in which the government's doing it is, one, it's going to lead to massive property tax increases and or significant service cuts for housing that's not even affordable. Like, that's what's so outrageous about it. So I thought I would focus more on where we are in the process and some things that we can all do, because I think I'm hoping most folks on this particular Zoom call agrees that Bill 23 is just a horrible, horrible piece of legislation. So it passed on Monday, but I would say, like most pieces of legislation, particularly with this government, the real devil is in the details of the regulations. And so those are posted right now in the Environmental Registry. The deadline for commenting on some of those regulations, the Greenbelt one in particular, is fast approaching December 4th, which I believe is Sunday. The government has agreed to extend some of the posting deadlines on some of the other regs, I think by 5 days or so, because they were getting so much pressure from municipalities for the reasons David noted, that they brought this in. Like, they've really completely upended planning in this province and essentially are turning it into the Wild West of planning with zero input from municipalities. The Association of Municipalities of Ontario, which represents 444, every municipality in the province, 444, except for the city of Toronto, they denied them to even speak at committee. They denied previous mayors to speak at committee. They denied municipal leaders to speak at committee. So there's been really no input whatsoever from the municipal sector. especially as it relates to planning and development charges. And so I would say to folks, don't give up and don't get discouraged, even though it's pretty hard in light of this bill being rammed through on Monday, because we can still push back against the regulations. And we have seen that people power has forced Doug Ford to backtrack on some of his worst policy proposals. We just most recently saw that with just the outrageous use of the notwithstanding clause to violate workers' charter rights, which was a huge victory for people power. In 2018, I'll remind everyone that with Bill 66, the government Schedule 10 proposed opening the Greenbelt for development, and a whole bunch of us organized. And a few months later, the premier backtracked on that as well. I've documented about 20 times since then that either the premier or the minister has said, we will not touch the Greenbelt. So they've made numerous explicit promises not to do it. And I can tell you, if you look across the province, and I would recommend going to Environmental Defense's website, or you can access their website through greenbeltpromise.ca. There's pop-up protests happening all over Ontario, a number of them happening Friday, Saturday, and Sunday this weekend. I'm going to be attending as many as I can. Obviously, there's the one at 11 o'clock in Guelph. There's one in Allura. I think at 2, maybe Candace, you can post that in. I'll be going to the one in Eden Mills, which I think is at later in the afternoon. Anyway, there's a number in our region. There's been a group of us. The Ontario Greens have been organizing days of action across the province, getting people to sign petitions and put up signs. And so you're probably seeing a number of signs popping up in communities across the province saying, you know, Doug Ford, keep your Greenbelt promise. If you haven't obtained your sign, go to greenbeltpromise.ca, order your sign. And if you could make a donation, because they're, you know, like money's tight. And these are just volunteer individual neighbors organizing against what Ford is doing. I think the biggest difference between what's happening now and what happened the last time he tried to open the Greenbelt for development is, I think Mike Derman put in the comment section, shock doctrine, or more recently using Steve Bannon's philosophy that he used with Trump, flood the zone. It's just so overwhelming. Like, you know, you could, like, between their use of the notwithstanding clause, bringing in minority rule through Bill 39, and revoking the Dufferin's Rouge Agricultural Preserve Act, which is just a whole other issue that's just completely outrageous. The fact that, you know, it appears that a handful of land speculators are going to turn millions into billions, and then just all the other things, CAs, Planning Act, Heritage Act, et cetera. It's just almost overwhelming to fight it all. So I think the one that has, the two that have the most potential to really push back on is the development charge changes, because of just what it's going to do to municipal budgets and the way municipalities are organizing against it. And the one that I think the people power and grassroots organizing have pushed back on is the Greenbelt one. Even though we want to push back on all of them, it's kind of like, those are the two that I think we have a chance of, like, really forcing this government to backtrack. So some of the things, in addition to supporting community groups, farm organizations, environmental groups who are organizing opposition, and in addition to organizing our own grassroots activities, I also, this week, you've probably seen, and I've been, feel like I've just been doing nothing but media interviews for the last 2 days. I did file a complaint to the Integrity Commissioner, requesting that the Integrity Commissioner conduct an investigation on whether or not Premier Ford and Minister Clark have violated Section 2 and 3 of the Members Integrity Act on the Greenbelt land deals. Because of the 15 parcels of the Greenbelt that's being opened for development, 8 of those parcels, so over half, have been purchased since Doug Ford came into office. One of them, most recently, an $80 million deal that closed just in September with an outrageously high interest rate. It's like, who buys land that's supposed to be protected forever for $80 million and pays 21% interest on the loan if they don't think something's going to come out of it? Like, it just like boggles the mind that there wasn't at least some information flowing to this particular individual. But I would say there's some real, you know, sort of suspicious and shady things happening just in general on a lot of these land deals. And it's been well documented in the media by media organizations across the political spectrum. So it's been multiple media accounts at this point. And so I don't know if the Integrity Commissioner is going to take up the investigation. It's really out of my hands at this point. I've done all the law, you know, did my work with the lawyer and all of that and have filed it. And now it'll be up to them. And then the other thing that I did was I introduced two pieces of legislation, Bill 44 and Bill 45. Which really are directed towards providing market-based solutions to the housing crisis. I've proposed a whole host of non-market-based solutions as well, like cracking down on speculation, investing in nonprofit and co-op housing, bringing in rent controls and vacancy rent control, and a host of other things that are non-market solutions. But I also felt that it was important to actually push the government and call out the BS that this Bill 23 is actually about housing, or any of their bills that have housing in the name are actually about housing. And so I wanted to say, not only are we saying no and opposing things, but we're actually also proposing solutions. And so what Bill 44 would do is something that the city of Guelph has pretty much already mostly done, but is in line with what most housing experts and advocates have been asking for, including the government's own housing affordability task force, which they seem to be ignoring and or explicitly violating, because the housing task force made it very, very clear that you don't need to open the greenbelt for development to address the housing crisis, that we have 88,000 acres of land already slated for development within existing urban boundaries in the greater, you know, Golden Horseshoe to build the homes we need. Was to put forward, so Bill 44 basically says, as of right, you can build fourplexes and four-story walk-up apartments within existing neighborhoods. So very gentle density that would maintain the integrity of neighborhoods, but would enable us to significantly increase housing. So one study that was done by Toronto Metropolitan University said that alone, and Bill, you'll be interested in hearing this, 435,000 homes could be constructed in Mississauga alone, just with that change, not to mention the rest of the GTHA. And then the other bill I put forward, Bill 45, would say that along major roadways and transit corridors, you would be able to build apartments between 6 and 11 stories. So municipalities would have the ability to determine, like, is 6 the right size for them? So I'm thinking, you know, smaller cities, they would probably go on the 6 side, and larger urban areas like Toronto on the 11 side or somewhere in between, whatever makes sense for a particular municipality. And that would develop the mid-rise development that so many housing experts are calling for, and would help us better utilize our transit and transportation infrastructure. So we stop building expensive car dependent cities. And again, that would help increase the rental supply, which would take pressure off of rental rates. That's not going to solve the issues we have around the need for deeply affordable and permanent supportive housing, which are the non-market solutions I've been putting forward. But at the very least, calling the government out that if you're serious about addressing the housing crisis, then let's pass some bills that actually address the crisis rather than these destructive bills that use the housing crisis to give them cover to dismantle environmental protections, planning, et cetera. So I'm going to leave it at that because I don't want to monopolize too much time and leave time for questions. But anyway, looking forward to the conversation as it moves forward.
Thank you, Mike. There are actually two questions for you. Now that you've made the complaint to the Integrity Commissioner, would it perhaps lead to a criminal investigation?
Yeah, it really depends on what the Integrity Commissioner would find. So the first step is whether the Commissioner is even going to do an investigation. So that's, so I've only made a request, and the Integrity Commissioner could say there's no reason to do an investigation. I feel like I've presented pretty compelling evidence. At the request of the Integrity Commissioner, I'm not going to make the details of that public at this point. And I've also been told the Liberals have said they're in the process of requesting an Integrity Commissioner investigation as well. So depending on the results of that investigation, it could go further into something more substantive, but I don't want to speculate on that at this time. And I also should say the NDP has asked the Auditor General to do an investigation on just the cost, the financial implications of these land deals, and you know, how much these people are actually going to make on this. So I think, you know, the opposition parties, I'll try to be as nonpartisan as I can be here, you know, are all looking at different ways in which this can be investigated. And I'll tell you, I was on News Talk 1010 yesterday with a very, very conservative, Jerry Agar. Anybody who knows radio hosts knows he's one of the most conservative pro-Ford radio hosts out there. And even Jerry conceded that my request for an investigation seemed like an appropriate thing to do because the government, I don't want to mischaracterize what he said, but I think it's just the government has a problem. This doesn't look good. So that's sort of the process of how it's going to, how it'll move forward.
Thank you. It makes me think of how insider trading is illegal. One more comment was made by Jay. Did I read yesterday that the Greenbelt is going to be expanded in Erin?
Yeah.
Is that a dig to Erin in that they rob Greenbelt from Peel and expand it into Wellington County, thereby saying, well, here you go, Greenies, you can have the Greenbelt and then deal with the developers who have purchased land in your region, thereby completely nullifying your regional planning? Is Jay reading this right?
Yeah, it may be a dig more at me, to be honest with you. Because I, as you know, I put forward the Periscope Marine Conservation Act, and let's just be very clear, the little tiny sliver around Erin is just a small fraction of the Periscope Moraine, but it gives the government an opportunity to say, oh, we're protecting the Periscope Moraine, even though it's like, I haven't done the percentage out, but it is a small, small fraction of the Periscope Moraine. Why they chose that particular location, I have no idea. I did talk to a couple of counselors there at the county had their like swearing in reception, the warden's reception the other day, and they had never been consulted, didn't even know anything about it. They first learned about it in the news, so who knows? But I want to be really clear that the 9,400 acres that they're adding to the Greenbelt, most of that land are urban river valleys that already have protections on them. They've been things, they are areas that people like myself have been advocating for to be Greenbelt protected as well. But there is absolutely no equivalency between taking protected land out of the Greenbelt and adding mostly already protected land into the Greenbelt. And I've been told, and I still need to verify this, that the lands around Erin are also have some protections, or some of those lands have protections on them as well. So there's a real false equivalency there. Mm-hmm. And then one thing I'll say, because I know so many people in Guelph are really interested in farming and affordable access to farming, and have recognized that especially for new farmers, the cost of land is a big barrier to people wanting to farm, because land is so expensive, and then it's hard to be profitable farming and cover those land expenses. And so one of the things the Greenbelt has done is it's taken the speculative bubble out of that land to make it more affordable and accessible for farmers. And the minute you introduce speculation back into the marketplace, which is what the government is doing with this, it means speculators are going to start buying up other greenbelt land with the hope that either with this government or another future government, they'll be able to make the case to take it out of the greenbelt and be able to develop it. And so that's going to create a speculative bubble within the greenbelt that's going to make it even harder for farmers to be able to purchase land and be able to make a living farming that land. And so this land swap is just a complete red herring and a bait and switch and a mischaracterization of land protection and what land protection accomplishes.
I would agree on that, if I may, Tanya. As I was saying, the really insidious part of this type of political practice, let me call it, is that it makes it sort of everyday life that in comes a new government and what was regarded as a public preserve, the Greenbelt, is now actually up for grabs. Yeah. So it's a little like Boris Johnson introduced the culture of serial lying. He lied to his electorate on an ongoing basis. And it became part and parcel of British politics, perhaps before, but he gave it a particular centerpiece. And the insidious part of this bill is that it makes the notion of a preserve and a public policy undertaking essentially leaves it up for seasonal grabs. That's the danger here. It's an insidious political practice.
Thank you, David, for expanding on that. And thank you, Mike, for talking about the barriers to farming, to new farmers, because the way I see it, opening up the Greenbelt sets a precedent, obviously. But I really appreciate you explaining that the Greenbelt stopped this sort of speculative bubble. Bill? We'd love to hear your perspective, especially since I would say you are a political pundit. So, Bill.
I also teach government relations at Seneca College. But anyway, so I first of all, I want to say thank you to Tanya and to Phil for inviting me. And what an honor it is to be here with David and Mike and with all of you this morning. I also like to say that going third after these very wise gentlemen have gone ahead of me have certainly cut into my comments greatly. So I'll cut it down and leave more time for questions. But this all seems very desperate, and we all feel very pressed by much of this. We've gone through such a long list of challenges lately, many of which have been mentioned. But I think there is in this crisis a great reason for hope, and one of those, and often when people finally get pressed enough and they start to organize and push back, you find the ability to make change. And I think you saw a bit of this south of the border in the U.S. election, that the attack on Roe versus Wade, which is completely unrelated to this, but it really focused a population that was very much in support of the maintenance of those rights, saw them threatened, and began to push back at the ballot box. And I think looking at the provincial election we just went through, that where we had historically low turnouts, where people were not engaged in the political process, there's less participation across the board. We need to engage people back in the process. And I'm often fond of quoting John Kenneth Galbraith, when he talked about the building, when he talked about how to build a good society, but he also talked about in his culture of contentment that people who don't feel served by a process don't participate in it, that those most likely to participate in our democracy are those who are actually the most contented. They are trying to keep what they have or enhance their value, which they're certainly getting from our current crop of politicians. But every now and then an issue comes along that focuses the mind when people become very clear that they're being lied to and that even some of the natural allies of the conservative government are going to push back. And in this case, it'll be municipalities are going to begin the process. But I think it's really important as we realize what a big structure and complex structure that the Conservatives have built over the last few years, preparing for these moments, that we organize and become very focused as opposition, become very focused on where we can win, where we can focus people's attention, and not get distracted by too many issues. Because I think it was Mike that said the zone's been flooded. We have to be bloody minded. We have to realize that we're marshaling limited resources. Where can we get the wins to build upon? And in many ways, this is reminiscent of the Harris government when they looked to put Toronto's garbage into the Adams mine. And you saw a group of people in Toronto, many of the progressive councillors there, many people who were in the environmental movement, and you saw people in the north, in indigenous groups, environmentalists, farmers, residents, who came together, became very disciplined and focused, working with the north and Toronto, and became the only group to stop the Harris government in a major way on anything. And they did it through community organization networking and just being very, very disciplined in how they responded. It took a long time, but they succeeded. They succeeded in keeping the garbage out of the north, and they succeeded in blocking the lesser known Bennett incinerator, which would have brought toxic waste from around the world into Northern Ontario. Now, I don't want to go into the history of that. I just want to tell you that there's an example of how we can win in Ontario, how we can become focused, and how we can push back. I think so. One of the things we really have to think about off the bat is that this, as both David and Michael have said, and Phil, that this is being very much used as a smokescreen, as a cover. The media and all the reporting is about the building of more housing, the addressing the affordable housing crisis. We need to not think of in those terms at all, because housing is important. Affordable housing is a desperate need, but it's not what this is about. And we need to get some very focused action on the housing crisis, but we need to separate these two events out. Saying that this bill, Build More Housing, is about affordable housing is wrong. It's really about development and supporting rapacious development in the province of Ontario. Saying the construction of Highway 413 was about better drive times is wrong. It was really about rapacious development and supporting friends of the government. And there, you know, there's lots of BS that's put out into the airwaves. I like the comparison with Boris Johnson and the ability to lie about everything. I thought Mike's head was going to explode during the leaders' debate in the provincial election when Doug Ford was talking about the amazing drive times that 413 was going to give people. An hour. We're going to save you an hour, folks. All very folksy. Complete rubbish, not based on anything, just made up and set out into the airwaves. And we're seeing this in the claims about housing development. So we have to become bloody minded. These things are not about housing. They're not about drive times. They're not about supporting municipalities. They're about restricting democracy. They're about rapacious development and doing anything possible to facilitate that under the cover of so-called more socially desirable issues. And as part of this, the notwithstanding clause falls into this as well, because it was ostensibly to keep those kids in the classroom. They couldn't care less about those kids in the classroom. What they did care about was restricting future labor rights and the ability of labor to push back on the many things they're doing. That spectacularly failed. And I think it is the germ of the hope we all have at building better networks across the province. But there's this is a big structure. It's not just about this bill. This bill was sort of popped up and was introduced and made the legislation at lightning speed. But this stuff's been going on for a long time. They've wanted to get rid of the green belt building of the green belt from day one. And because of pushback, they sort of slowed it down a bit. But it was never not the goal. They're pushing Highway 413. They've brought in the extensive use of municipal zoning orders to override legislation. They've attempted to use the notwithstanding clause in the most recent case, but the problem with that was they successfully used it to deal with third-party advertising and thought they could get away with it again because there was a little pushback in the past. They still have that tool out there and they'll be willing to use it if when the time comes. They've gutted the powers of local conservation authorities to affect development and to push back against development. They're proposing and this is very disturbing, the direct appointment of regional chairs going forward, which will allow them to override provincial objections. And again, is an overreach in terms of impacting local democracy. They're shackling municipalities' ability to pay for service. They're putting costs onto municipalities. The Association of Municipalities of Ontario is estimating up to $5 billion. I would tell you over a 10-year period, that is probably a very conservative number. Municipalities have very few revenue options. The City of Toronto has more under the City of Toronto Act, but most municipalities are governed by the Interior Municipal Act, which gives them things like development fees and property taxes and very little else. And by restricting their ability to collect development fees, something that, for instance, where I, Michael mentioned where I lived in Mississauga, the city lived on municipal fees in its early development up until quite recently, and rightly or wrongly didn't increase taxes, local taxes for at all for many, many years, and lived on those fees. Now that space is running out, the municipal taxes are shooting up, but a lot of the development north of the city into Peel has been what I would call the McCallion model, is that you keep local taxes down and you get revenue for the city simply by living off development fees. Now they can't even do that. And then they have development without the benefit. And now they can't even get the money for it. So they're gonna build all these new developments. They won't have the ability to pay for public transportation, for road, sewer, all the other services, park development, social services, local municipal infrastructure, because they won't have the money for it. That burden will be added. And now the hope to turn to the federal government to find money, if you look back, is just mind-numbing. And if you look back to the 1990s, the federal government reduced its deficit by downloading it to the provinces. And the Harris government then reduced its deficit by downloading it to the municipalities. And that is happening from the provinces trying to go in both directions, which is quite amusing. I've been quite troubled by how silent the federal government has been on many of these things, particularly around 413 and other projects over the last few years. And I'm hoping that they stand up and really take on the environmental assessment roles they have and do some pushback. But I also don't think that it's a good idea for the federal government to start funding municipalities directly. I think municipalities have to assert their independence. They're going to have to somehow push back to the provincial government and make a difference. Anyway, I feel like I'm all over the map on things, and that's part of the problem. It is flooding the zone. There's a lot of issues, but I think we have to we have to begin with protest, but we have to get back to protest, to well-considered networking, organization, and targeted outcomes from the pushback. Pushing back on the democratic deficit that's being created and the illegality, I think ultimately you're going to see in how this whole thing came together to fund the development. I think careers are going to be made in the legal profession. I think careers are going to be made in journalism and academic careers, studying how really dirty this whole thing is going to be. And I think that we need major study, major review, And I think other, I think at the end of the day, there needs to be law enforcement has to take a careful look at how the money's moving around this province. What we are not talking about, because we're talking about provincial legislation, is all the things that have been going on at local regional councils. All the items have been coming out of nowhere, supported by developers in opposition to staff recommendations in many cases to local development and projects. And where does this come from? Where are all these influences come from? And you can see it in municipality after municipality after municipality around the region. It's a very well coordinated kind of scuzzy effort that I think we really need to get into. But to believe that this is about, to believe the premier that this is about affordable housing, to believe that it's about drive times and congestion, you might as well believe him that if he was to say that he enjoyed porn for the acting, because of the acting. I mean, it's just it's a Robin Williams line, but I think it's just the point is it's utter BS, and it actually makes Boris Johnson look like an angel. It's very, very disturbing. Forgive me for my run-on mouth. I'll leave it at there.
Oh, no forgiveness will be given, because we appreciate your insight.
Thanks again for those incredible analyses that we've just received. There are a number of things that were raised here, and I think perhaps the first one that needs to be addressed is affordability. I struggle with this whole question of affordability because there's so many aspects to it. And I think we need to avoid the term affordable housing and rather look at accessible housing, accessible and available housing to people based on income. Traditionally and conventionally, 25% of a person's income was supposed to go to housing. And this causes me some consternation, because on a minimum wage, it would be incredibly difficult for anyone to be able to afford virtually anything that's available in a community like Guelph. But this raises another issue, because what we're really dealing with is a government that is reluctant to address wages and address affordability in the very broad sense. And that includes food, that includes virtually any commodity that anyone might need. We've got a significant economic deficit that we're addressing. And I wonder, as I heard Bill and I heard Mike and David, whether in fact what we have is an approach by this government to essentially atomize the issues to the point where we're all very confused. This isn't about a green belt. It's not about affordable housing or accessible housing or whatever you want to call it. It's not about wages. It's not about unions. It's in essence about divide and rule. And I think that what was expected was that the issue of protecting the green belt would cause a conflict with those who were believing in housing and divide many of the advocates for fair housing prices from those who believe in the environment or believe in water conservation. Many of you are aware that here in Guelph, we have a real problem, because if we actually grow the way the government is telling us to, this puts our water supply and that of even worse of Kitchener-Waterloo under significant threat. And when someone is without a house or someone is without green space, then we have an issue that behooves us all to recognize that this is a social challenge for us all.
Thank you, Phil. David.
Well said, Phil. I think of the 5 years I spent on and off being educated by the Haida, and recalling their story of Claycott Sound and other events where civil society gets around to saying no, gets around to it, says no, no more, we're not taking it anymore, as the movie said, and we're going to take action. And whether we go to Gandhi for this or when we find other sources of inspiration, the notion of action locale, as activists in Quebec have called it, in rural insurgency, this is on the cards, and it's legitimate in democratic societies. Picking up on Bill's, I think, very useful scene setting. Yes, local government in Canada is one of the weakest systems of local government in the OECD. So in terms of comparison with Norway, Denmark, Amsterdam, the Netherlands, Germany, and many, many other comparable countries, or federations, Australia and Germany and elsewhere, we've one of the most weakest systems of local government in the world. Canadian municipalities access 8 to 12% of the total tax pie. 8 to 12%, that's all they get. And yes, are people looking at this, if I may, with the conflict of interest, perhaps refer you all to the forthcoming special edition of the Canadian Geographer, which is on local government. And I had the pleasure of writing a piece that I referred to as the neocolonial turn. And I believe our local governments are still stuck in the 19th century when it was a colonial setting, and they're acting essentially in a neo-colonial manner. So local governments are not only the creatures of the province, but through the Strong Mayors Act and through Bill's reference to the appointment of regional chairs, what we're getting is that the key people who will be making autocratic decisions throughout local government in Ontario will be, are you ready? Provincial agents. They will be agents like the old Hudson Bay agents. They'll be agents of the powers that be. And that's exactly what's going on. So we do have a structural issue on our hands here, disguised under various things that Phil has indicated, but so peel off the mendacious veneer and we're dealing with power and the fundamentals of democracy. Thank you.
Thank you, David. I was listening to the CBC yesterday, and a recent poll indicated that the third biggest concern of Albertans is their provincial government. This is in Alberta. So this shows that governments in general are upsetting to their citizens. I have a few questions from the chat. I think, Bill, you touched upon this. Will the provincial government ask the feds to underwrite the losses created by the decreases in development charges?
Mike may be a better person for that. I can just go from the comments I heard from the Minister Clark the other day, that they were looking to recover some money they felt they were owed from the federal government of about $1.5 billion towards this. I think the situation that they're hoping for is that municipalities will be so desperate that the, you know, Bonnie Crombie and John Tory will appeal to the federal government. The federal government will try and fill a need, feeling that there's a real crisis there, and will bypass the province. That's probably not a good thing, because it's probably what the province wants. But Mike's probably much better to speak to this than I am.
So the province has been very explicit, frankly, in the House and outside the House, that they're asking the federal government to fill it in with the housing accelerator funding.
Yeah.
That is not what that money was for. Like, that money's for accelerating the building of truly affordable housing, not to replace development charges. So I don't think the federal government's going to take that bait, because they know that, it's a bad deal for municipalities, bad deal for the federal government. And quite frankly, the provincial government is, you know, we're sitting on a $2.5 billion surplus right now, largely from unspent federal funds that the province is essentially hoarding at the expense of our healthcare system, housing, municipal budgets, education, et cetera.
Okay, thank you. One person has commented that we need to stop using the phrase housing crisis and call it an affordability crisis, because when we use housing crisis, the government can frame the debate on their terms. And I would like to add that I've spoken to some people who believe that opening of the Greenbelt is a good idea, because it will increase the supply of housing, first off. And secondly, with regards to local democracy, he doesn't want for story walk-ups in his backyard. So he wants his counselors to represent him. And that's his version of democracy working well.
Well, it's not an uncommon point of view. That the European model, where they've looked at intensification, they've very sharp divides between urban and rural land, is definitely what we need to gravitate towards. But you're going to find a lot of homeowners and people in middle class housing in the cities are going to be very unhappy with that. And I've certainly seen that in municipal politics in this region over the years. But I think the other thing is that we're of a generation where people do not have a sense of the rural and the northern anymore. That our parents and grandparents, they were fairly connected to their roots and their families in rural spaces, and they had a sense, they had a gut sense of what that meant. We don't live there anymore. We live, part of the reasons these things are able to happen is that people find it difficult to contemplate or what the loss of rural land means, what the loss of natural spaces means. Yes, if you poll them, they can tell you that they really care about these things, but they don't vote on that basis because it doesn't touch their reality. They don't have a visceral sense of what that means. We're going to have to start developing that somehow and educating people a bit more. And that, I understand how hard that is to do, but the arable land in Ontario is actually quite small. And we have the sense living in great big Canada that we can move, that there, you know, there's always space. And with and this is a stunning mindset that's out there, but it's common that we can just move north with global warming. Well, we can't. There is no more soil. We're losing 330 acres of farmland per day, which is a staggering rate. The average farm in Ontario, I think, is 300 acres. So we're losing land at a heck of a rate, and we're losing so many other things. How do we take that fellow you talked about and that problem and deal with it? I was at a Green Belt meeting years ago, and there were farmers there, and one of the pressures they had was retirement. Maybe the federal government could help by coming in from the other side and say, we're going to support the incomes of retiring farmers so that they don't feel so much pressure to sell to developers and to give up that land that way. We need to try and pay it from both, protect it from both directions. It sort of helps define how big a challenge it is to get people to internalize how vital all these realities are. And we're environmentalists or we're municipal activists, and we all have our little pockets. There needs to be a grander vision and a linking of groups and a coordinated development plan for this province and a coordinated pushback to the developers in this province so that the tail no longer wags the dog. There's nothing wrong with development if it meets the public interest and follows the directives of democratic our democratically elected structures. There's a huge problem when they're driving the show, and that's where we are in this province.
Just to add to that I very much agree with making sure we use the word affordability in our language. I do think in the case of housing, we need to say housing affordability, just because right now the two biggest stress on family and individual budgets are housing and food. And so I think it's really important to say housing affordability crisis. And if you'll notice, the government's language has shifted to housing crisis, and they talk about attainable housing. So they've really dropped the word affordability and are using the word attainable. So whoever wrote that, I think it's really important to keep emphasizing housing affordability, but I don't think we can drop housing because just so many people are desperate for housing. And then the pushback around gentle density and intensification is absolutely there. There's no doubt about that. There's literally no doubt about that. And my main response to that would be is, if you look around Ontario and around the world, many of the most desirable places where people want to live, the places where people like, this is amazing, vibrant, livable, wonderful place to live, has that kind of gentle density with fourplexes and four-story walk-up apartments, because you can sustain a population that allows for, you know, neighborhood cafes and restaurants and other amenities and services within a neighborhood. So you can actually walk or ride your bike to easily access those things and not have to drive across town or be stuck in traffic to get to those places. And so if you look, that is when people point to the amazing places to live, it tends to be those kinds of neighborhoods. And so right now in Ontario, we have this false choice that it's like tall or sprawl. Mm-hmm. And there is so much housing in between tall and sprawl that would lead to and is demonstratively led to in many locations, including right here in Ontario, to amazing places to live. And quite frankly, places that are more affordable to live because it is so less expensive to provide services to those communities. And it's not the kind of density you see with, you know, tall skyscraper buildings. It's literally gentle density, human scale neighborhoods that then can support great amenities that to serve people. And so part of the challenge is to have those conversations with people, like be willing to have conversations with people who oppose your position and work through those differences and understand to be empathetic, but also, you know, talk about the wonderful opportunities that exist. And that's very challenging in our political culture right now that's driven so much, you know, by social media and, you know, staying within bubbles of people that we only agree with and not talking to people we disagree with. And it's one of the reasons that I always emphasize, and I know it's incredibly inefficient and hard work, door knocking, because one-on-one conversations with neighbors is how we get through these social media bubbles and lack of good local journalism and so many of the things that have really broken down and created barriers to effective communication in our communities.
I would agree, and I would like to amplify Mike's comments here. The centrality of conversations, can't overemphasize that. And conversations take place best in communities. It's hard to have a conversation the length and breadth of the province, yet the length and breadth of a construct we call Canada. Look at the federal government, Alberta, brittle, fragile, and somewhat dismantled conversation at the moment, and so on. So these conversations can and should take place in communities. We're very good at that. We're used to it. There's a long, long history in Canada of communities working together, talking together, arguing, debating, splicing and dicing issues and so on, and coming up with solutions. Canada is extremely rich in this record of community-based development, largely based on respectful conversations. So I can't overemphasize that. I would also like to add into that conversation the notion that the standard house, the sort of thing that is basically Canadian, is 1,500 square feet, 2,000 square feet, 2,500 square feet, with 2.8 people under the roof. That is not Canadian. That was invented sometimes shortly after the Second World War and in the 50s and the grand old days of sprawling suburbia. And sprawling suburbia is not a fact of Canadian life. It's an invention. Most Canadians, around the Second World War and after the Second World War, lived in houses that were around 900 to 1,200 square feet. And by the way, they were occupied under that roof with 4 to 6 people. So the per square foot consumption of floor space and land in Canada, we've quadrupled it, if not quintupled it, in the last 30 to 40 years. So the way we have been living, especially since the 1950s, is something of a bubble. It's a myth. It's actually almost unnaturally Canadian. We're more used to living in higher densities. We don't all have a sprawling backyard. We don't all have two garages sort of hiding our house and so on. That's an almost unnatural design that became part and parcel of the Canadian landscape. But it's certainly not a sort of an inherited natural part of the Canadian DNA. It's a recent invention, and we need to sort of put that in the conversation. So higher medium density, graduated densities, infill, multi-purpose, mixed development, walkable neighborhoods, and also those sort of things. They're very much part of the Canadian urban fabric. Sprawling suburbs are not. They have been something of an aberration.
Could I just add one quick thing? Because I think this is such an important conversation, and I think it's the biggest barrier to us addressing the housing affordability crisis in a way that protects our farmland. And Guelph has some great examples. So walk along Queen Street. I mean, there's an apartment complex literally next door to Linda Hasenfratz's house. You know, I just, every time I walk by there, I'm like, and holy Guelph, we have like an apartment complex right next to Linda's mansion. You know, like, this is awesome. Or walk through the ward and see some of the new developments that's happening, repurposing existing buildings. And I'm thinking, no wonder the ward is such a desirable place to live in Guelph now, because all this great repurposing of industrial buildings into living space, and combined with some other rehabilitation of housing in the ward, it's like now all these little businesses are popping up in the ward. And it's like, what a great place to live. And you can still walk downtown, you know, like, and I was just doing some videos in Toronto where I was standing in front of four-story walk-up apartments that are literally next door to single family homes. And it all fits together beautifully in a neighborhood. So I think there are so many great Canadian examples of what David is talking about. And so I think we have to show them, talk about them, to overcome this fear of the unknown, because people have been told over and over again that your only choice is a single family suburban sprawl house or, 60-story condo in downtown Toronto. And when you're told that over and over again, and those are the only examples you're ever shown, it's hard to imagine anything else. But we have so many Canadian examples of just better communities to live in if we just had the choice to be able to live there. But we haven't been building those kind of communities, and we have a real opportunity to do that, especially with the new generation of young people who especially want to live in those types of walkable communities.
Thank you to all three of our guests for joining us today. I have learned so much. I'd like to make a few closing remarks. Remember that Bill 39, the Better Municipal Government Act, is making its way through the legislature. And finally, there is a review of A Place to Grow and Provincial Policy Statement, and you can comment on those by December the 30th. Ontarians are mobilized, and we will continue to push back against these harmful proposals. Please join the rally in Guelph on Sunday, December 4th. We're meeting at the Covered Bridge at 11 a.m. And now I am going to move on to announcements. Have your say. It's the Ontario edition. The consultation deadline for all manner of Bill 23 nonsense is on December the 9th. The consultation deadline for the review of A Place to Grow and the provincial policy statement is December 30th. Please Google AMO, Consultations More Homes Faster Act. Have your say about water, wastewater, stormwater. Please comment and do the survey between November 30th and December 20th. Have your say about the community engagement framework and policy update. Have your say about single-use plastics and what is your take on the fees for single-use bags and cups and the minimum cost of reusable grocery bags. This survey is open until January the 2nd. On December the 2nd, December's Deputy Mayor Aaron Caton will be raising the flag at City Hall to mark the International Day of Persons with Disabilities. And that day actually falls on December the 3rd. And the theme this year is removing visible and invisible barriers. Likewise, there will be a disability donation drive between December 1st to 9th. There's a donation bin in the lobby of City Hall. What they're looking for are meal replacement drinks, incontinence products, unbleached menstrual products, and totally natural, scent-free, chemical-free personal care products, and special diet non-perishables. Next week, we're going to be talking about multi-year budgets. And on December the 15th, for our last Breezy Breakfast of the year, we're meeting in person at Rise and Shine Restaurant. Bring your books and convince us why we should read them. The CEO of the Guelph Public Library will be there, Steve Kraft. And again, I'd like to thank everyone for being here today and see you next week.
Special thanks to our esteemed guests for taking the time to explain almost everything we need to know about Bill 23 and housing in Ontario. Breezy Breakfast, where the conversation is warmer and the winds of December by a Greenbelt mile. Music provided by Jules Sturm. I'm Jiayu and I produce this podcast.